I'm going to be talking about the idea of universal human rights, and no matter how fast I talk, I will not be able to tell you everything about universal human rights in 15 minutes. But I do want to encourage you, if you have questions or you want to continue the conversation, we can do it after the session. One of the questions that we're going to start off with is this: where did the idea of universal human rights come from? And as we all know, the Declaration of Independence gives us the answer to that question. It says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, and that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, my question is, and we'll actually just gonna leave out the Creator, but how about just that all men are equal and that they are endowed, they have certain rights, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness? How many people here think that's self-evident? Raise your hands. That's always an interesting question. You know, if I'd asked this question 10 or 20 years ago, more of you would have raised your hands, I think. But what's interesting is, what I should have done before I asked you that, I should have said, what does self-evident mean?
Natural happening.
You're confronted with barriers and you feel that I have the right. You know, that's actually, I think, starting to capture where human rights come from. But you know what's interesting? Self-evident is a word that comes from philosophy. And it actually doesn't aim at that at all. Does anybody know? I mean, I wouldn't expect, but any philosophy majors here who know where self-evident came from?
Sui generis.
Well, that you're right to say it just hits you, right? But it has to hit you in a certain way, because lots of things hit you, but they don't count as self-evident. Anybody, well, here, I'll give you a hint. If you were to ask somebody in philosophy, what's an example of something that's self-evident, they would say, how about this? 2 + 2 = 4. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, why is that self-evident? Well, I'll tell you why. Because no rational person could disagree with it, right? And you see, the authors of the Declaration, particularly Thomas Jefferson, they wanted to make a very strong statement. And so they were claiming no rational person could disagree with this. Was that true in 1776?
Well, no.
No way, right? As a matter of fact, if anything was self-evident, let's just say to educated people in Europe, it was that people are not equal. It seems self-evident they're not equal, and people should have different rights and obligations. But here's the thing. Maybe the authors of the Declaration of Independence were saying, yeah, but all those people are irrational. We're the only rational ones, and it's self-evident to us, right? Now, you see, if you know anything about the history of philosophy, this is a sad part of the history of philosophy, is often these philosophers start to say things that imply I'm the only rational person, everyone who disagrees with me is irrational. But here's the thing, suppose, I don't think they were doing that, but suppose they were, I claim we could tell it wasn't even self-evident to them. How could we tell that it wasn't even self-evident to the authors of the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal? You are so right. I mean, see this, you don't have to have a background in philosophy to know this. Here we go. Whoops. A majority of the 57 signers were slave owners.
And were there any women?
We're going to get to that in just a second, but first, we're going to get to that. Thank you for asking that question. We are definitely going to get to that. But first, I just want to stick with the men, because sometimes when I talk to people about this, they say, well, but wait a minute, they didn't regard the slaves as men. Now, I think there's something right about that, but if you're just literal-minded, as I am about it, that's not true. And the way we know it's not true is if you were to see, for example, that if you were to look at auction posters for slaves, when they have an auction, they list so-and-so, like one of them says, 47 able-bodied men. See, they were men, but somehow or other, they were left out of this document. Ah, but now my next question is, everybody here knows that often still men is used generically to refer to men and women, right? You're familiar with that usage. And certainly back then it was often done. And so my next question is, when they wrote this document, were they speaking generically? And now it might have just been, you know, certain groups of men, but they also mean to include women in the list of rights. Let's take a vote. We're going to take a vote here. How many people say, yes, they did mean to include women? Oh, you're such a jaded group. When I ask my undergraduates, a lot of people raise their hand. Well, you better be, I see, it's even worse than that. But yes, you're right. He heard him say they didn't let him vote, yes. Because to my undergraduates, these things do sort of seem self-evident. It's so taken for granted. And you have to step back and see how unself-evident it was. Well, we know that they didn't mean to include women because John Adams was in Philadelphia, and when he was there drafting the Declaration, Abigail, his wife, wrote to him and said, in the new code of laws, which I suppose it will be necessary to make, I desire you would remember the ladies and be more generous and favorable to them than your ancestors. Could you have written a more non-threatening way of saying, she didn't say, we demand equal rights. Just please do better than your ancestors. And John Adams wrote back, as to your extraordinary code of laws, I cannot but laugh. You see? Are you kidding me? Actually, what?
And he valued her.
He valued her. This was one of the ideal male-female relationships. But the idea, the very, as a matter of fact, I don't put the quote up here because it's sort of offensive, but I'm going to translate it into non-offensive language. And the quote is this. We've had lots of crazy ideas and no one has suggested that. That's the next paragraph of his letter. And now you see, what we can say is we have a real appreciation for how non-self-evident this idea is. And so that really motivates us to more say, where did it come from? Right? Okay, well, the first one, not from an articulation of self-evident truths. As a matter of fact, here's the irony of the Declaration of Independence. If they had published 2 + 2 = 4, would people have gone to war over that? Right? You couldn't go to war over something that was self-evident. But, you know, I can't even count the number of documents that have been called revolutionary. This is one that is literally was revolutionary. Could not have been self-evident. Okay, how about this? Did the human rights come from a top-down process led by cultural and moral authorities? Right? You can think about the different religious authorities or government authorities. Is that the history of human rights?
No.
Let's take a vote again. No, I mean, everybody, there's somebody. No way, no way. I mean, you can look at individual cases, but like slavery, you know, the Pope had slaves. Every major religion has a document that either endorses slavery or something equivalent, like in the Hindu system, the untouchables caste. Okay. How about this one? This one, you know, in the literature on human rights, the most common explanation of universality of human rights is they're the rights that everyone agrees on. I say, well, do you mean just even like all moral and religious traditions? And that's what they claim. I would be a millionaire many times over if I had a dollar for everyone who has said that's what universality of human rights means. So now, how many people here have actually read the UN Universal Declaration? I wonder, it's just sort of interesting to see. Okay, so enough of you, but you may not remember them all, but my students, they all read it, you know. And so then I ask, are there any rights in the UN Universal Declaration that all moral, religious, cultural authorities agree on? You know, there's not a single one. And so this is the very common notion of universality. And if that's the correct notion, then people should be saying there aren't any universal human rights. Wow, that's really interesting then, because now we're getting to a puzzle. A puzzle is we're looking through the different ways that people have tried to understand the universality of human rights. And so far, the best we can say is if that's the way we understand universality, there are no universal human rights. Oh, by the way, on the Universal Declaration, when I've been teaching philosophy of human rights for a long time, when I taught it back in the 1990s, one of the rights was a right against torture. And so when I taught it back then, I said, well, maybe there's one right on the UN Universal Declaration that there's universal agreement on. And then what happened? Oh my gosh, nope, there's not even one. Okay, well. How about this? Human rights are a Western European idea, and so they're not universal. They only apply to Western Europe. Now this one, I could be a millionaire. I could easily be a millionaire if I had a dollar for everyone who has claimed this. Are human rights a Western European idea? Is the Western European tradition a tradition of human rights? And again, if I had more time, we could go through them, but I'm just going to do one here. Religious tolerance. Is the Western European tradition a tradition of religious tolerance? Zagorin wrote a book on the history of religious tolerance. And you know what he said? The Christian tradition is the most intolerant tradition in history. Now, I'm not saying this to dump on the Christian tradition, because there's a lot of intolerance all around the world, but here's what's interesting. If the most intolerant tradition in history could actually develop the idea of a right to religious tolerance, we ought to be asking ourselves, maybe there's some basis for that right in every culture. Yeah, you have your hand up. Wow, let's honor that. And as long as we're honoring them, I want to take you back to the 3rd century BC. How many people here have heard of the Emperor Ashoka? Emperor of India. The Emperor of India, this is before Christ, right? And the Emperor Ashoka had a problem. You know what the problem was? Religious strife. And he said, I've got a solution to that. We will tolerate all religions. And as a result, Ashoka is still revered today as having one of the most prosperous reigns of any emperor in India. So we have a long historical lineage. I just wanted to go back far enough so that everybody could see it's not a Western European idea, okay? What was it? It was the result of a largely bottom-up process of moral transformation. When I say bottom-up, I mean it in two ways. One, it's not coming top-down from the authorities. Often the authorities are the last people to get the word. And so, but it's people like us, and also people who are experiencing human rights violations. And the first reaction is not, oh, there's some universal human right. That takes a while. It's just, this is wrong. Remember the woman over here was saying, it's actually situations where you're experiencing, this is wrong. And it may take a long time. And if I had more time, I would give you some more of the historical context to get an appreciation for the process and how it works. But here's the thing. I don't have time to do that today, but we're all living through it. And so we all have experienced this process. And so the process, for example, in my lifetime, look around the women here, how much progress is made on equal rights for women, even though the Equal Rights Amendment was never adopted. Someday it will be. How about rights for gays, lesbians, transgendered, and other? That's unbelievable, the transformation there. But there's always room for more progress. And so here's a really interesting, every time I teach philosophy of human rights, there's some interesting development. And of course, the big development now is Trump being elected president, which is definitely a big development for human rights. But I want people to see there's no way Trump can stop this either, because it's a bottom-up process. And what have we seen just the last 2 to 3 weeks is huge, huge awareness of the issue of sexual harassment. Right? Huge, huge awareness. Now, all the women in this room, don't you go out and say, oh, Bill Talbot thinks that problem is all solved now. What I want you to do is I want you to get a sense of the process and how it happens, and it's bottom up. The term sexual harassment didn't exist until the 1970s. It was completely invisible before that. And I'm going to end in just a couple of minutes here. So what I'm going to do is I want to say, actually, when we think about the history of the development of human rights, and there's a history of a moral development, and there's certain important stages in that moral development. And one of the really important stages is the development of different versions of the Golden Rule. And if we had more time, I would talk about them. But what I do is I want to tell you about one kind of development beyond the Golden Rule that I think is very helpful for thinking about how it is that people are able to conceptualize human rights and where the ideas come from. And that's called the Harsanyi Rawls original position. Has anybody here ever heard of John Harsanyi or John Rawls? John Rawls. Yeah, John Harsanyi, he won the Nobel Prize in economics for his contributions to game theory, but he also was an interesting moral philosopher. John Rawls is, okay, I'm going to tell you, John Rawls, most people know about the original position test from John Rawls. I'm going to actually, I just want to tell you a variation on it. And the situation is this. For any society, it could be your local community, it could be your country, and I'm extending it beyond Rawls, it could be the whole world. You can ask the question, what rules should we have to govern the relations between us? And in particular, you can ask, what rights should we guarantee? But this works for all the rules. And so when you ask that question, Rawls, Harsanyi gave the idea, but Rawls developed the idea. Think of it this way. Step back and consider, what rules would I agree to if I were behind a veil of ignorance? Not ignorance of everything. How could you make any agreement? All I'm ignorant of is all identifying information about myself. So that imagine yourself looking down on this world that you and the others there are making the rules for that world, and you could be anyone there. And when you do that, what you see is there are certain things that are actually no-brainers. They've actually taken hundreds of years to develop, but they're no-brainers. Equal rights for women? Protection against sexual harassment? In the original position, is somebody going to argue for sexual harassment? Or really for, you know, because you don't know? So it's a really fascinating thought experiment that I encourage you to use when you're thinking about issues of human rights. And you'll find if you do it, sometimes they're hard questions, but there are a lot of them that are no-brainers, and you will then be able to see how we are part of a history where those no-brainers are eventually getting enacted into law and protected. And what I suggest to you is this, and this is where I'll end now, is that we're actually part of a historical enactment where no one ever actually said, go behind the veil of ignorance. But articulating ideas like the Golden Rule, that's what's happening. People down below are thinking, what would be the terms that we could all agree to? And implicitly, what they're thinking is we could agree to them no matter what position we were in. And I hope that'll help you when you're thinking about the history of human rights and where it's going. Thank you.